Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some interesting articles from the October 2021 issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Don DeMont. Before he gets into how he made a name for himself and how John Denver fits into everything, sculptor Don DeMont wants to talk about the family business that taught him and launched him. DeMont Corporation, my family's metal sculpture company, had a 20-year run, DeMont says, from his studio in Loveland, Colorado, where he relocated in 1993 after falling in love with Colorado in the 1970s. At its height, his family's California-based company had a crew of 80 people making thousands and thousands of pieces that were sold across the country in a successful gift line. A lot of people contact me today to confirm that they have a DeMont sculpture, he says. Some people cherish and keep them. Others choose to sell these 35 to 40-year-old pieces handed down from their parents. Those vintage pieces show up on eBay and Etsy and in movies. Movie prop houses have contacted me for permission to use one of my sailboats on a shelf or on a desk as a backdrop. I've spotted them in episodes of Cops when they are filming in someone's home, and more recently in the movie Ted. In the 80s, the TV show Dallas contacted us to purchase 20 of my gold-plated oil derricks to decorate the tables in the Cattlemen's Club, where they shot many scenes. And the White House even called to get a declared value on a DeMont sculpture that had been given as a gift during the Reagan administration. While still working his day job designing for the family business, DeMont would spend his free time creating his own projects. After work, I would go back into the shop and play, something I learned early. Never give up on a sculpture, he says, remembering a particular turning point when perseverance paid off in a new direction for his career. I was building an airplane and working on the skeleton of the fuselage, which I was going to wrap in metal. It wasn't working, and I got frustrated and threw it into the rock pile. When I picked it up, it was crushed, but it came alive. I painted it in German colors and added some bullet holes and a skeleton of the pilot hanging out of the cockpit. I set it on a desk where a sales rep saw it and said, "My boss was shot down in World War II. I've got to have this piece." So he bought it, just like that. That bit of serendipity set DeMont on a path of creating his own original sculptures. In the early days, everything from airplanes to sunken pirate ships to carousel horses. These days, his custom sculptures tend toward Western rustic old freight wagons, zigzag or split rail fences, wagon wheels, old mine remnants, and Indian teepees. Whatever he's creating, though, the piece will include his signature aspen trees. To make his trees, which can be as tall as 3 feet, DeMont has evolved a meticulous method that starts with digging through piles of alabaster mined in Colorado, and then sees him chipping, pressure washing, drilling, sculpting, welding, painting, gluing, sealing, drying, and finally, signing the work. An astonishing, even onerous, amount of hand detail goes into each one-of-a-kind piece. The process is so time and labor-intensive, it sounds almost antithetical to the creative inspiration underlying it. But ask DeMont about the universal attraction to aspens, and you discover the poetic heart that is the source of his focused devotion to rendering them in his art. The stark white trunks with the black eyes and their vivid fall colors, the way the leaves quake or shimmer in the breeze, the way they grow in groves by the thousands in high altitude, with the majestic Rocky Mountains as the backdrop. When collectors call me about my work, it's usually the first thing they bring up, how my sculptures take them back to Colorado, where they have such fond memories of how striking the aspens were in the fall, whether they were just driving through, on vacation, or have a second home there. If you've ever flown over the Rockies in the fall, it looks like the mountains are on fire, with no smoke. It wasn't a hunting or fishing trip or a second home in the mountains that drew DeMott to the Rockies. It was John Denver. He inspired me to come to Colorado and see what he was singing about, he says. Denver's Rocky Mountain High had come out in 1972. 7 years later, its lyrics imprinted on him. DeMott was driving back to his then home in California from Texas and decided to take a scenic route through southern Colorado. There, he saw aspen trees covering the countryside, and the inspiring sight changed his life. He began working on a way to recreate the beautiful trees in metal. Ironically, DeMott's aspens were bare winter trees since he hadn't yet figured out how to fabricate leaves. It was the first of these winter aspen sculptures that he donated in 1981 to an auction benefiting John Denver's Windstar Foundation. Exploring the auction site before the evening's event and needing help with directions, DeMott ran into a helpful stranger along, almost disguised in a bulky winter coat, hat, and sunglasses. It turned out to be Denver. At the auction that night, my first aspen piece was sold in a lot that included an original landscape photograph taken by John Denver. There's a photograph of John Denver holding up my very first aspen sculpture. Following Denver's example, DeMott would spend his summer vacations in the 1980s camping in Colorado and photographing the aspens. All the while, he was working on his process for sculpting the trees, eventually launching a gift line called Colorful Aspens in 1989. He retired the line in 2001 and began refocusing solely on the originals he creates today. He's been in Loveland for almost 30 years now. To this day, I'm still in awe when I see the fall colors of the massive aspen groves high in the Rockies, DeMott says. Just before sundown, when the angle of the sun is just right, thousands of aspens of yellow, orange, red, and splashes of light green glow as if someone flipped on a light switch. Seeing this recently, I had to pull over, get out of my truck, and catch my breath. I looked in another direction where this mountain was already in shadow and saw fall colors forming a stripe, winding down the mountain, tightly surrounded by thousands of pines. It was a stream bed from the snowmelt where aspens grew along both sides of the water. Within a few minutes, a sculpture and title came to me, River of Fire. I said to myself, well, my work is done here, and I got back in my truck and drove on. Better than ever. A Colorado vacation house with plenty of room for improvement becomes a dream retreat for a Texas couple and their extended family. As a real estate developer based in Austin, Texas, Frank Trabold knows a thing or two about enhancing environments. So when it came to remodeling the 10,000-square-foot vacation home he and wife Colleen purchased in Vail, Colorado 5 years ago, Frank had a clear vision of what would make the modern mountain retreat better. I always try to improve things, and this house had a lot to be improved, he says with a laugh. One of the main issues was that the home didn't take full advantage of the spectacular scenery just outside its doors. The living room fireplace, for instance, filled up a good portion of one of the exterior walls, blocking the views of the surrounding mountains and river. Additionally, the modest deck out back felt more like an afterthought than a focal point. "We wanted the outdoors to be brought into the house," Frank says. "But creating an indoor-outdoor connection was just the first goal of what would become a full-scale, years-long renovation. A job that included installing 12-foot windows and glass doors in the main living area, almost tripling the size of the back deck, reconfiguring the kitchen, converting the basement level into a family room and bunk room, and much more." To get the property in tip-top shape, Frank and Colleen knew they needed the right team in place. So they called on architect Greg Wyatt and interior designer Cherry Martin, both based in Dallas, to handle the design. And they hired David Hyde out of Vail to head up construction. The result is a luxurious, light-filled showplace where nature is celebrated indoors and out. To furnish the expanded patio, designer Cherry Martin chose a variety of seating options by Janice et Shea, including the rockers around the new fire pit and the chairs in the separate lounge areas. The deck's frameless glass railings provide safety without obstructing the view. Before the remodel, there was only one way to access the lower level of the house, so the Trabolds added this glass-railed stairway that leads from the main floor to the basement. Cherry completed the look with an installation of John Pomp glass pendants that she calls functional art. The lights can be seen from the street and from the back deck, mimicking the appearance of a starry night. "There aren't many areas of the house that we did not touch," says the homeowner, "and that includes the previously rustic exterior, which now features a copper roof and clear cedar siding alongside the original stone cladding." The Trabolds have three adult children with spouses, as well as one grandchild and another on the way, so the house needed to be able to sleep a crowd. Though the lower-level bunk room was added with the grandchildren in mind, Cherry put a sophisticated spin on what is typically thought of as a kid's space. The custom beds, queen size below, twin size above, are outfitted with serene blue bedding, custom pillows, sleek sconces, and USB outlets. One of the most transformative updates in the main living area involved moving the fireplace from the window wall to an interior wall in order to open up the views. The stone around the fireplace was carried over from the exterior, creating another link between inside and outside. To add extra seating in the combined living and dining space, Cherry created a two-sided banquet upholstered in a bold Martin Lawrence Bullard fabric. The space needed to work and be comfortable for 2 to 15 people, she says, and the banquet is like art in the center of the room. The dining chairs are by Berman Rossetti. The basement was just an unfinished space when the Trabolds bought the house. Now it's an elegant yet comfortable family room. But with the wood on the ceiling and the stone on the back wall and floor, Cherry knew noise was going to be a problem. So she added fabric panels on the remaining walls to absorb the sound. The sofa, swivel chairs, and coffee table are by Holly Hunt, and the painting is by Houston artist Cookie Ashton. The backsplash for the wet bar is a mirrored tile by Ann Sachs. Previously a mud room, this powder bath features Ann Sachs' petrified wood marble tile on the floor, a Philip Jeffries grass cloth wall covering, and a custom-built demi-loon vanity backed by a wall of bronze tile. "It was meant to be a very soothing room, so our colors are soft and muted," Cherry says of the homeowner's bedroom. The acid-washed hair on hide rug from Truett Fine Carpets and Rugs in Dallas perfectly complements the wooden-framed bed and its neutral pillows and linens. The new floor-to-ceiling windows offer expansive views of the surrounding landscape. Though the kitchen was reconfigured to make it more functional for the Trabold's specific needs, they were able to save many of the bolt-hop cabinets, just refinishing them in a lighter shade and adding brushed brass hardware. The island, complete with a raised breakfast bar, is a custom design, and the countertops and backsplash are explosion blue quartzite. It's so dramatic, Cherry says of the durable natural stone. We wanted something that was going to bring a lot of color. Cowboy Cauldron. Fire, food, and the human need to gather around both gave Mike Bertelson a great idea for a company. By Lindsay Welchel. We humans have a lot more in common with ants than you might think. Harvard University biologist E.O. Wilson, who studied ants for decades, concluded that an aspect of their social behavior was largely related to having a defensible nest, a fun fact you might learn in conversations with Mike Bertelson, owner of luxury fire pit maker Cowboy Cauldron Company. Humans gained a defensible nest when they mastered the art of fire, says Bertelson, who grew up in Utah loving the outdoors, hunting, and, one assumes, encountering plenty of ants. He has studied Wilson because he's intrigued by how fire has brought humans closer together. All of our behaviors are predicated around the sort of communication that happens around a fire, Bertelson says. In any situation where a group of people arrange themselves to have a conversation, they get into as close to a circle as they can be, whether that's in a living room or around a dining room table. To Bertelson, face-to-face interaction is so important that he built an entire business around bringing people closer together. His circle just happens to be around a cauldron filled with, you guessed it, fire. Growing up, Bertelson, like lots of kids, loved playing with fire. He was also an avid hunter who liked to cook what he caught. His eventual career path, law school followed by a move to Washington, D.C. to become a lobbyist for the mutual fund industry, took him far from the outdoor lifestyle he was accustomed to, but his Western lifestyle roots remained. Living in Virginia near Mount Vernon, he got permission to bow hunt and fish on the grounds of George Washington's historic home. His Senate liaison work in D.C. was basically entertaining for a living, which meant frequently hosting friends, colleagues, and other assorted influential guests at his home and cooking a great meal for the occasion. Having ruined the family grill that had been a housewarming present from his mother-in-law by building fires right in the base, Bertelson had to get serious about honing his live fire skills. At a Christmas celebration at Mount Vernon, Bertelson was inspired when he saw a colonial heating brazier, and the idea for Cowboy Cauldron began to take shape. He sourced the steel and finalized his design to create a structure that was big enough and strong enough to perform well as a fire pit and grill, while still being beautiful, clean, and capable of helping him entertain his sophisticated political guests. The result was highly successful. In the political milieu, Bertelson says, people have two very disparate psyches. They have their personal life, and then they have their professional life. They keep the two very carefully bifurcated. But around the fire, those guards are let down and a level of trust evolves, especially over time. The wonderful dynamic about the cauldron was that it became sort of a sacred space for everyone. That human impact has helped fuel the mission of Cowboy Cauldron ever since. The cauldron allows people to arrange themselves in a circle, look into each other's eyes, and be both side by side as well as face to face. In that context, real social interaction occurs, Bertelsen says. Cowboy Cauldron allows people, particularly in this transient, disposable digital age, the opportunity to interact on a very real or personal human basis. And I think that's important. Starting a business making cauldrons wasn't really Bertelsen's plan, but he had gotten tired of the political pressure cooker of D.C. and wanted to raise his children in an environment like the one he'd enjoyed as a kid. So he and his family left Washington and moved back to Utah. There, he continued to foster friendships and community around his cauldron, and he eventually caved to his friends' constant begging to make them replicas. Word got around, and friends of friends began to request them. Eventually, Bertelsen decided to go for it and form a company. That was in 2008, but things really took off in 2010 when the cauldron was featured on the cover of Napa, California, Culinary Gift Catalog. Initially, there were two models of cauldrons, one built by hand from solid plate steel, a large model called the Ranch Boss, and a substantially smaller one called the Urban Cowboy. To meet growing demand and to be able to offer a fuller range of options, the company has since come out with other models, the Wrangler and the latest and smallest, the Dude. Anybody who sees a cauldron loves it and wants one. But the big ones are pretty large, and not everybody has a place in their yard to keep one, Bertelsen says. Previously, size was sort of a limiting factor. But with the addition of the Dude, it's no longer an issue. The Dude breaks down. It has segmented legs, so it can go in your car, to the beach, or in the storage unit of your condo. You can set it up by the pool at an apartment for a party, then take it down and take it to a friend's house, whatever. So I feel really good about expanding the ability for most people to be able to have live fire in their life. Besides their quick setup and takedown, extreme durability and adjustable height basin, cauldrons are versatile, whether people are cooking or just congregating. When people use their cauldron, it's called a burn. The word is both a noun and a verb, used as a rallying cry for friends to join together around the fire. We really don't sell a fire device, Bertelsen explains. We sell the hosting experience. Some people only burn them. Not everybody's a foodie. Not everybody can cook on fire, but by and large, the cauldron changes the way people entertain. It changes the way they use their yard. They also tend to sprout. If somebody has a cauldron, pretty soon all of their friends have one too. The great thing about the cauldron that makes it different, he says, is that it's beautiful and it's clean. When you're done, the next day you don't have a bunch of burnt logs and blackened rocks sitting in your yard. You've got a piece of sculpture that looks as nice as it did before you used it. And there's a big component of the seasonal extension for your outdoor life. You can snug right up under the cauldron and be toasty warm on a really cold day or night. You can interact, and you can cook. Though the cauldrons are used in many commercial settings, such as hotels and resorts, Bertelsen loves it that people choose them for their own backyards, because it's so personal. The feedback from customers has been gratifying. People love them. Our customers become zealots. I get telephone calls and emails of people from all around the world showing pictures of what they're doing with their cauldrons. Having been a lawyer and a lobbyist with the impressive resume that goes along with his former career, Bertelsen is proud of the fact that with the Cowboy Cauldron, he's created something tangible. When we're done with a day's work, There are physical objects that have value to people, he says. I think the most seminal piece for me was really early on when somebody came up to me and said, "That thing is the coolest thing I've ever seen. I want to buy one from you." I thought, well, you know what? If that person who works hard for their money wants to spend it on something that I make, then it needs to be the best I can possibly make it.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading articles from True West, October 2021 edition. The Tombstone Street Fight by Mark Boardman. Shot for shot, Bob Bowes Bell captures what C.S. Fly missed 140 years ago. Where's the photo? October 26, 1881 in Tombstone. One of the most celebrated events in Old West, maybe American, history. Eight men face off in an empty lot behind the OK Corral. 30 seconds, 30 bullets, three die, two are severely hurt, one is grazed, four run for the hills. All march into history and legend. Where's the photo? C.S. Fly, a prolific and, with his wife Molly, gifted photographer, who ultimately takes some of the great shots of all time. His studio abuts the empty lot to the south. The Earps and Doc Holliday have their backs to his building, just feet away. But no photo of the gunfight. What happened? Well, apparently Fly was caught by surprise. The whole town was, including the participants. He was doing something else as the guns went off. He didn't have time to set up his equipment. And when silence came to town, Fly had another calling, to go into the lot to check on the participants. He took the gun from the hand of a dying Billy Clanton. And then the bodies, living and dead, were removed. And maybe Fly was too stunned to think of photographing the bloody grounds. So, no photos. Until the next day, when Fly captured the bodies, well-dressed and laid out in coffins, of cowboys Frank and Tom McLaurie and Billy Clanton. Thus, the Old West field is left wishing that things were different, that Molly or C.S. Fly had been prescient enough to have a camera ready to go when the gunfight began. Even then, a photo would have just been an image of one moment in time. It couldn't tell the whole story. It could not paint the perfect picture. This is what artists have been doing for more than 120 years, trying to paint or sketch the perfect picture of the Tombstone street fight. They've taken the various oral and written accounts, the evidence, the analysis compiled since 1881, and mixed it into colors to be placed on the canvas or whatever material they choose. Our own Bob Bowes Bell is one of the premier chroniclers of the fight. Since his first attempt at age 12, don't ask how long ago that was, he estimates he's tried several hundred times to paint, sketch, scratchboard the shootout, including the lead-in events, the aftermath, and the participants. Bell figures he's gotten more accurate as time has passed and more information on the gunfight emerges. Some are little details, like Tom McLaurie's silver hat band, or Wyatt Earp carrying his pistol in an overcoat pocket. But they're important, if for no other reason than many viewers, or potential buyers, know those little facts and expect them to be correct. As noted, a piece of art, like a photograph, is a snapshot of a specific moment in time. Unlike the photo, though, it goes through the filter of the artist's mind and arms and hands and fingers. A camera merely reports on what it sees. An artwork is an interpretation. That can give it more power, say when the painting is in color and the photos of the period are in black and white. Artwork can provide perspective on events because the portrayal reflects the biases and opinions of its creator. But that also means it may not be entirely accurate, so historians have to take it with a grain of salt and a dollop of skepticism. With all that in mind, let's look at a few of Bell's greatest hits, OK Corral style, Let's see just how well he hits the mark. The first image is a color painting. Most of it is neutral colors, and you see the tops of the top halves of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 men, and then a seventh man who looks like he's about to get onto a horse. They all have guns, they're wearing hats, and they are all pointing at each other. It looks like much of the image is obscured by the smoke that apparently is coming from the pistols. Caption accompanying photograph, Bob Bozbell's gunfight at the OK Corral was painted in 1981 for the centennial of the October 26, 1881 shootout in Tombstone, Arizona Territory. The next image is more of a close-up of two cowboys. One cowboy who is holding the reins of a horse is wearing a black hat and a darker shirt with a lighter colored vest over it. And then the other cowboy on the right side is wearing a white hat and lighter colored clothing. Both are very well dressed. Both have mustaches and they seem to be looking off toward the right. Caption accompanying photograph, the McLaurys. Tom and Frank, upper left, anticipate the motive of the oncoming Earps. Note the silver hat band detail on Tom's hat. The next photo looks almost more like a drawing, and it is in black and white. It is with five cowboys. On the right side of the photo, next to that cowboy, there stands a horse. Caption accompanying photograph, the cowboys. The cowboys had regrouped west of the OK Corral rear entrance just beyond flies in the side yard outside the window where Doc is boarding. The next photograph shows five cowboys that are standing side by side. They all have pistols. One of them seems to have a walking stick or a cane, and they're wearing hats, well-dressed. Caption accompanying photograph, looking for a fight. When Sheriff Johnny Bean confronts the Earps and Doc with the news that he has disarmed the cowboys, Virgil and Wyatt both pocket their pistols, but the four men continue toward the cowboys. The next photo is taken from above and to the left of the four men. You see one of them, actually all of them, are wearing fairly long jackets of some sort. One of them is holding a rifle, and the other cowboy that's in the front is holding his walking stick. The other two men, you do not see any weapons. Caption accompanying photograph, turning the corner. Virgil and Wyatt walked ahead of Doc and Morgan two by two as they entered the vacant lot. Back to main text. A colorful depiction. The first is one of the artist's better known paintings of the street fight. It is a depiction of many moving parts. Billy Clanton is at the extreme left, falling into the Harvard House wall as Marshal Virgil Earp, directly across from him, fires away. Just beyond Billy, two horses are rearing in terror at the gunfire and sudden movements. Tom McLaurie is out of view, behind one of the horses, probably trying to reach for a rifle in a saddle scabbard. Doc Holliday is barely seen to the right of the horses. He's leveling a shotgun, trying to get a clear shot at Tom. Frank McLaurie is up next for a moment. He's already been gut shot, but that hasn't taken him out of the fight. He's hit Morgan Earp on the ground with a bullet that went through his shoulder and damaged his shoulder blades. Wyatt has a protective stance over his brother while firing at Tom McLaurie's horse. There's more blood to be spilled over the next 10 to 15 seconds, but that is for another painting. And to be honest, there are many well-known parts not covered by this painting. But this painting does what it's supposed to do, provide a colorful look at a historical event as conceived through the eyes and mind of a talented artist who is also a history nut. Bell has also covered almost every movement, hour by hour, of the participants in the street fight on October 26, 1881. He has meticulously done his research for over four decades, even restaging the events and the gunfight participants with reenactors in historical locations. With tension and drama, his black and white, duotone, and color illustrations capture every perspective of the Earps and Holiday, the cowboys, and the streetscapes of Tombstone on that fateful October day. His sketches and illustrations vividly capture the points of view of all of the combatants and visualize the scenes of the day, including Virgil's dramatic proclamation, "Hold on, I don't want that," just before the first shots are fired. The black and white depiction. Bell has done hundreds of black and white pieces on the street fight. One of his best captures the shootout just seconds before the moment captured by the color piece. He believes that this one may be one of his best in terms of accuracy. Note that Ike Clanton is hightailing it toward Flies, escaping the carnage that he helped start. Morgan Earp is going down after being shot in the shoulder by Tom McLaurie. Wyatt and Virgil Earp are firing at Billy Clanton and Frank McLaurie, both of whom are shooting at the lawman. Doc Holliday, the closest to Fremont Street, is using his shotgun to get after Tom McLaurie, who is obscured by his horse. At this point, it appears Billy Clanton is going down after being hit a couple of times. There's no indication that Frank has yet to put a bullet in Virgil's right calf. The gunfight is about half done. A couple of other observations. First, the gun smoke is thicker and heavier than in the color paintings, and that is more accurate, considering the testimony and the firearms of the period. Second, the faces are more indistinct, less detailed. That gives the piece a frantic, confused aspect that correctly reflects the atmosphere in the empty lot on that cold afternoon. None of these guys were anticipating a shootout. They really didn't want one. So it was a surprise when the guns went off. The adrenaline started racing, and all were acting out of instinct, not through knowledge or experience, which is why two-thirds of the 30 shots fired missed their mark. Sure, black and white automatically means that something is missing in the interpretation, color, but it has its own striking feel and presence. Which does the artist favor? I don't have a preference. I just want to get it right and be authentic, Bell says, except when I'm being snarky and want to make a point. Which brings us to, I had my pistol in my overcoat pocket where I had put it when Bien had told us he had disarmed the other parties. When I saw Billy Clanton and Frank McLaurie draw their pistols, I drew my pistol. Wyatt Earp. How old are the gunfighters? Virgil Earp, 38. Ike Clanton, 34. Wyatt Earp, 33. Frank McLaurie, 32. Morgan Earp, 30. Doc Holliday, 30. Tom McLaurie, 28. Billy Clanton, 19. A man with a long coat on walked up to the man holding the horse and put a pistol to his stomach, and then he, the man with the long coat on, stepped back 2 or 3 feet, and then the firing seemed to be general. Addie Borland. Blow by blow. Beneath this headline are several photographs of drawings and depictions. The first photo is titled Backed Into a Narrow Space. It's very indistinct, and it's taken from slightly above and a bit far away. You can see the men between several of the buildings, and we're seeing maybe the backside of two horses, as well as from behind of five men, and then there are two men on the other side in front that are facing those men. Next photograph is called Morgan and Doc Armed and Ready. We see at the front of this drawing the image of a man. He's wearing a hat, he has a mustache, and in his right hand he has a pistol drawn. He's looking toward the left of the photograph. And then just behind his left shoulder, his right shoulder, more indistinctly and further away, we see another man. That man has a rifle and a hat. The next photo was Tom McLaury armed? In this photograph, again, black and white, we see a man who is behind a horse, and he has his pistol drawn, and his arm is resting on the saddle. The next photograph is in color, entitled The Stage is Set. This one we see in the background a building. We see one, two, three, four men who are looking in the other direction, who's looking opposite our point of view. We have five men who are looking toward us, and a couple of horses. Again, this drawing is in color, but very indistinct, which adds to the drama and tension of this photograph. The next photo is titled The Firing is Fast and Furious. And again, it's in color. It's indistinct. And we see several men and they're shooting at each other. We see a couple of horses in the background. The next photograph is called The Fight Has Commenced. Much of the same. A building is in the background. This drawing is in color, but again, very indistinct. And we just see the mayhem of the fighting that are going on. Several men who have pistols, one who has a rifle, and then the two horses that are near the building. The next photo is taken from above, such as from a drone. And what we see are the positions of all of the men involved in the fight. It's in color, it's indistinct, and you can tell where the artists have put each of those men. Its caption reads, after the first two shots, there is a pause. All of the participants are stunned by the abruptness of the shooting. In 27 seconds, three men were killed, three were wounded, four fled, and one, Wyatt Earp, stood unscathed. The next image we see is under the heading Witness Statements. And this drawing shows the image of a town. It looks almost kind of like a map, and it shows with the arrows where different people and places were at the time of the event. At the top of the page, it says October 26th, 1881, Tombstone, Arizona Territory. And I'll read the text in this image says. The first one, I walked down as far as Fly's rooming house. There I saw Sheriff Behan and four farmers. As I approached, one of them, William Clanton, put his hand on his pistol, as if in fear of somebody. He then recognized me and removed his hand. William Cuddy. The next quote, when I got to the corner of 4th and Fremont Streets, I saw a large crowd of people on 4th Street near the gun shop. P.H. Fellahy. I told Sheriff Behan that we were just going to leave town and that I had no arms on. He then searched my waist. Ike Clanton. I was in the OK Corral at 2:30 p.m. when I saw the two Clantons and the two McLaurys in an earnest conversation across the street in Dunbar's Corral. R.F. Coleman. I slept the day of the shooting. Got up about 1 or 1:30 in the afternoon, went to the barber shop to get shaved. While there, heard somebody say there was liable to be trouble between the Clanton and the Earp boys. John Behan. I first saw Frank McLaury on that pretty day near the Grand Hotel as they were riding in. Frank McLaury, Bill Clanton, and an old gentleman who I am not acquainted with. This was about 2:00 in the afternoon. At first, Doc Holliday went out and shook hands with one of them in a pleasant way and said, how are you? Or something like that. William Allen. I was coming from my home to the meat market, Mr. Bowers, to get some meat for dinner. I passed into the shop. The parties inside seemed quite excited. They said there was going to be a row between the Earp boys and cowboys. Martha J. King. The day this thing happened, I went down to Dr. Gillingham's office with Ike Clanton to assist him in getting his head dressed, and then I walked up 4th Street. I met Billy Clanton and Frank McLaury, and Billy asked me where was Ike. He said he wanted him to go home. William F. Claiborne. Back to main text. Snarky and making a point. Bill has done the fight six ways to Sunday, as he says. Generally, the pieces are connected by the search for accuracy. But occasionally, BBB will turn things around a bit to make a point. Beaux art, let's call it. One such effort, which is also one of the artist's favorites, shows the cowboys with their backs quite literally against the wall of the Harwood house. Their hands are raised in surrender. Only two of them, Billy Clanton and Frank McLaurie, are armed, and both weapons are holstered. As the two sides face off, Virgil Earp orders the cowboys to throw up their hands, and they immediately comply. The Earps and Holiday then open up on the men, getting off five shots before the cowboys can return fire. This is not a gunfight. It's a massacre, a murder. And to emphasize this viewpoint, our audacious artist has placed halos over the heads of the Clantons and McLaurie's. This is based on the testimony of Ike Clanton at the so-called Spicer hearing into the incident, which took place just days later. Others, including Sheriff John Behan, support that view. But it didn't wash with Judge Wells Spicer. The bullet wounds suffered by the cowboys could not have happened if their hands were raised. And if this scenario was accurate, how the heck did Ike Clanton walk away unscathed? He helped inflame the situation with his boasts and threats. And yet Wyatt Earp allowed him to make a run into flies? That's part of the reason that the Earps and Holiday went free. Oh, and as to those halos, our artist is making a point. I did that to show how ridiculous the idea is that they were choir boys. That is satire, not authenticity. Bell exceeds at satire in all media and in person. The bottom line. The bottom line. Works of art are the closest thing we'll get to a real depiction of the events of October 26, 1881, excepting reenactments. And for many, that might not be enough. We live in an age when we can use a smartphone to video all sorts of events, catching all the action, all the people, all the elements. Some such videos have made their own sort of history in the past few years, so we're spoiled. Our expectations are way out of whack, especially when it comes to the past. Sure, there are movies, but Hollywood has shown an aversion to accuracy when it comes to the OK Corral. Heck, even using that name is way off. The wrong people die or are wounded. The gunfight goes on for 10 minutes, and dozens of shots, or maybe more, are fired. The list goes on and on. Many of us have given up on Westerns to tell the true story of the Tombstone street fight. No doubt, art from people like Beaux Bell is limited in what it can do. It probably can't depict all the movement without blurring the people. It can't show the reality of gun smoke without obscuring the entire picture. We can't know the exact facial expressions of the participants. Placid, stern determination, pain, frozen terror. A painting can't capture the noise and the smells associated with the gunfight. Still, artwork can spur further pictures of the mind that help fill in the gaps, that extend the image both forward and backward. It can move us to imagine what Tombstone was like on that day. And most importantly, it can spur us to investigate the people, places, and events that made Southeast Arizona so fascinating at the time. The history is out there, in words and more, available to one and all, including through magazines like this. And the art, when done well, adds a great deal to the experience of exploration. But with all that said, there's always the inclination, the desire, to go back in time, visit the photography studio next to that empty lot, find the proprietor, grab him by the lapels, and shake Buck Fly to his core. Where's the photo? There are two more pictures, and these are actual photographs from back in that time. The first photograph that's shown is of three men in coffins. They are dressed in suits. There are overlays of things on top of the coffins. The coffin is half open, so you can see the images of the faces of the three men. Caption accompanying photograph. Photographer C.S. Fly's boarding house and studio are right next door to the empty lot of the shootout, but he missed all the action of the gunfight. The only photo he took of the participants is his famous image of, from left, Tom McLaurie, Frank McLaurie, and Billy Clanton in their caskets. And then the final photograph below this is a very blurry photograph. And we see a picture of a burro who is hauling something, a great deal loaded onto his back. You can see the image of a building that's just behind him, and then another building or structure that's to the right side of the photograph. Caption accompanying photograph. The only known photograph of the street fight location between the Harwood House and Fly's is his random shot of a wood hauling burro. Mark Boardman is the features editor at True West, the managing editor of the Tombstone Epitaph, and pastor of Poplar Grove United Methodist Church in Indiana. Bartlesville, Oklahoma, by Peter Corbett. The 150,000 boomers and Sooners who flooded into Oklahoma Indian Territory starting in 1889 were seeking land. The next big wave of frontier fortune seekers were after oil, black gold, and oh boy, did they find it. In April of 1897, George Keeler and William Johnstone hit the first commercially successful oil well in the territory at Bartlesville with the Nellie Johnstone No. 1. It spouted 100,000 barrels of oil over 50 years. That gusher launched a boom in the Osage oil fields of the region. Oil patch camps named Woolco, Carter 9, and Whizbang popped up. In two decades, the Osage wells produced more wealth than all of the American gold rushes combined, according to the Oklahoma Historical Society. A century later, Bartlesville visitors can see the city oil built in northeastern Oklahoma. It starts with a replica of the Nellie Johnstone oil derrick that erupts with gushing water from the Caney River. Until you see that simulated oil well erupt, if you're not from Oklahoma, you can't really grasp how big those operations were, said Maria Swindell Gus, a Bartlesville native and tourism bureau director. Attractions include the Woolah Rock Museum and Wildlife Preserve, Tom Mix Museum, and Pioneer Woman Mercantile. Woolah Rock, a mashup of woods, lake, and rocks, started as a 1925 lodge for oil man Frank Phillips and his wife Jane. It now includes a 50,000 square foot museum and a preserve on 3,700 acres with buffalo, elk, and longhorn cattle. Phillips, a barber turned banker and oil baron, founded Phillips Petroleum Company in 1917 with his younger brother, Lee Eldis, or L.E. The Phillips brothers built it into one of the world's largest independent oil companies. Their ventures included Phillips 66 gas stations. The first one opened in 1927 in Wichita, Kansas, with gas selling for 11 cents per gallon. Bob Fraser, CEO of the Frank Phillips Foundation, which operates Woolah Rock, said Phillips wanted a place where he could entertain business clients away from his New York City office. Mr. Phillips made the comment several times that if he could get a man into Woolah Rock, he could get him to sign any deal, Fraser said. He signed a lot of deals at Woolah Rock. Phillips's collection of Western art features works by Frederick Remington, Charles M. Russell, and Thomas Moran. A Colt firearms collection has some of the first revolving cylinder weapons. Woolah Rock is hosting an art exhibit and sale October 15th through the 17th. It features Cowboy Artists of America painter Grant Redden, Puget Sound sculptor Perigene O'Gormley, and artist Sherry McGraw. The show runs through the end of 2021. The foundation also oversees the 1909 Frank Phillips Mansion in Bartlesville, which is open for tours. The Phillips Petroleum Company has a museum in Bartlesville, and the Bartlesville Area History Museum is in the former 1913 Hotel Mayer building downtown. The Tom Mix Museum in Dewey honors the King of Cowboys, a silent screen superstar who made more than 300 films. Mix had roots in Oklahoma as a bartender in Guthrie, a Wild West show performer, and a night marshal in Dewey. The museum's collection includes his personal possessions and film memorabilia. It even has the suitcase that reportedly delivered a fatal blow to his head in a one-car crash near Florence, Arizona in 1940. Pawhuska, 30 minutes west of Bartlesville, is home to the Pioneer Woman Mercantile in a restored 1903 building. The Merc General Store, Cafe, and Bakery were developed by Food Network star Ree Drummond and her rancher husband Ladd, who she refers to as the Marlboro Man. Bartlesville tourism director Gus and Ree Drummond traded her black heels for tractor wheels in returning to her hometown of Bartlesville from the big city. "It's been huge for all of us," Gus said of the Pioneer Woman's impact on area tourism, especially as people returned to traveling after the pandemic. Tourists this fall may run into director Martin Scorsese, who's filming in the area a screen adaptation of David Grand's book, Killer of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI. Peter Corbett moved west to Flagstaff in 1974 to attend Northern Arizona University, where he studied English and American Studies. He's been exploring Arizona and the West since then, and had a 35-year career in Arizona journalism.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.